This is an ABC podcast.
In 2011, Anne Summers appeared on a postage stamp under the banner Australian Legends, commemorating her work as a feminist, a journalist and policy advisor. That same year, Vogue named Anne one of the world's wisest women, while Good Weekend magazine called her one of the world's most influential women. To the outside world, all was going brilliantly. But it didn't feel that way to Anne. She hated her job and even feared her whole working life might be over. This has often been the case in Anne's life. Big successes and big letdowns. Sometimes it seems almost at the same time. Anne wasn't raised to live a big life, but that's definitely what she has chosen. Her new memoir is called Unfettered and Alive. Hi, Anne.
Hi, Sarah.
What was expected of you when you were growing up?
I was expected to live my life through other people, I think. I mean, the only models for women I had around me when I was growing up were my mother, who was a housewife, as women were known in those days, with six children. Her sister, well, she had several sisters. One sister was a nun, and she had another sister who was, in the unkind language of the time, a spinster. She, in fact, was the most interesting of all the sisters, I thought, my Auntie Nance, and she had a job. She worked in a bank. She had money. And she was very, very important to me as a young teenager, and I saw that being a housewife, a mother of six, as my mother was not the only option available to me, whereas the nuns at school and certainly my family talked as if it was.
Out of those six kids, where do you come in the lineup?
I'm the first and the only girl.
You went to a Catholic school in Adelaide. What did the nuns make of you?
Oh, I was, played up a lot at school. I was very, what's known as a naughty girl and always getting into trouble.
Around what sort of things?
Oh, I think just being, I was probably bored. In those days, I mean, the schooling was just, it was just shocking. I mean, when I did Leaving, which is now, I think, year 11, I think it would be called now, there were 60 girls in the class and one nun who taught every single subject. And it was shameful, really. And we didn't have a library or we didn't have a laboratory. We had no science teaching. We had nothing. I mean, it was a very inadequate education. And I was, obviously a bright girl and I was interested in things. And I think I just felt very frustrated by the world in which I found myself. But I used to play up and I was very, very nasty to some of the poor nuns who had to teach me.
Was there any nun who saw something in you?
There was, actually. I mean, I've talked about this woman. I mean, she's a very, very interesting character. I knew her as Sister Mary Vianney. And when I was about 12, she was my grade 7 teacher. And she really opened my eyes to music, to poetry, to reading, to a life of the mind in a way that I was just absolutely fascinated by. But at the same time, I was also drawn to wanting to be with the girls who were popular and the girls who played sport and the girls who, got dates and things. So I kind of resisted, I think, being drawn into the world that she was offering me. And I got myself into some terrible trouble one day. I forget what I did, but whatever it was, a major drama at the school and I was dragged before the headmistress and I was punished. And this Sister Mary Vianney took me aside later and she said to me, look, don't be an idiot. Those other girls are idiots, but you're not. You've got a mind, use it. And that just completely changed my life, her saying that to me, because she made me realise that I was actually in charge of my life and I didn't have to just go along with the mob, and that, I knew those girls were silly. But there was no other model really for how to behave because they were popular and everyone wants to be popular when you're a kid, a teenage girl. So she really saved my life in so many important ways. And what was very interesting is many, many years later, in fact, in the year 2000, and a year before I'd published a book called Ducks on the Pond, which was an autobiography, and I received a letter in the year 2000 from a man by the name of Roger Ellis from Wales. And he wrote to me saying that one of the nuns from the school that I'd gone to, Cabra Convent in Adelaide, had sent the book to him and he'd read it. And he wanted me to know that for the past 30 years he'd been happily married to Sister Mary Vianney, who was now known as Kate Vianney. And so she'd kept Vianney, her religious name, as her surname and taken Kate. And that was very interesting because before she went into the convent, her name was Lillian Horgan.
She had a complete reinvention.
Yes, which I thought was a beautiful name. And I don't know why she, but after getting this letter, next time I was in Europe, in London, I took a day off and took the train to Wales and met them. And it was a very, very special moment. She was suffering very badly from Alzheimer's. And so she had no idea who I was. But that didn't really matter. You know, it was to me, I just really wanted to see her and I guess pay a little, you know, private tribute of thanks she really saved me.
So that was what was going on at school. What were things like at home when you were growing up, Anne? How was your relationship with your dad?
I was terrible. I mean, I had a very, very difficult childhood, partly because my father, I think, didn't know how to cope with having a daughter. I mean, it was okay until I got to adolescence, and then he just couldn't cope at all. He had a really serious drinking problem, and, you know, whenever he was drinking, he was very... He wasn't violent, but he was aggressive, and he was verbally violent, and he was... But he was just hostile to me, incredibly hostile, and basically I was frozen out of all family activities. And I left home the second I legally could. I mean, literally walked out the door when I could. It meant leaving school earlier and just getting out of there. It was a pretty horrible situation, and I was very, very unhappy, and I resented him greatly. But in other ways, you know, it really toughened me up, and it made me able to cope with adversity and to cope with hostility and rejection, which I'm very grateful for now. Not that I'd recommend this is a way to do it, but I am grateful that if somebody rejects me or doesn't like me, you know, I don't go to pieces. I don't care, you know, I don't care.
Tell me about Elsie, the refuge that you were involved in setting up.
I was in a share house in Sydney in Annandale, and we, you know, had a nice little house, and we had a little backyard that was completely enclosed. You know, you couldn't get to it except through the house. And I was at home with Linda Ryan, who I was sharing the house with. And she and I think we were just having a cup of tea or something in the kitchen, and we heard this screaming in our backyard. And we just thought, I mean, how can this happen? No one can get into the backyard because, you know, they have to come through the house. And we went out there, and there was this young woman with a baby, and she'd literally come over our back fence. And the fence must have been 6 or 7 feet tall. And she'd come over the fence holding the baby, and she was yelling for help because her husband or partner was beating the crap out of her. And so we took her in and we tried to help her and gave her a cup of tea and, you know, whatever we did. But that incident just changed my life.
And where could women in a situation like that go? Where could they seek refuge?
There was absolutely nowhere. I mean, there were places run by the Salvation Army and St. Vincent de Paul, which were known as shelters. And what they were like sort of these vast dormitories where a woman and her children could go and sleep, but they couldn't stay there during the day and they couldn't leave their stuff there. So if a woman went to one of these places, I mean, she'd go to the sleep the night and then she'd have to go and find somewhere to stay during the day. And so what these women would do, they'd grab their suitcases and they'd go down to the Central Railway to one of the cafes there and sit there all day with their kids and having to, you know, eke out cups of tea over the course of 6 or 7 hours until they were allowed to go back to the place. And it also meant that they had no one to mind their children while if they had to go to the court to try and get a, you know, an order or to try and go to the magistrate and get some welfare payments or whatever it was. So when we came up with the idea of the refuge, we knew that it had to be a place where women could leave their stuff, where the women could leave their children and know they'd be safe and cared for, and that we also needed to provide the service of helping women with legal advice, with medical advice, with advice about Social Security, scarcely existed back then, but, you know, there were whatever payments there were that they needed to get help from us in doing it.
So did you volunteer there at the refuge yourself, Anne?
I did for a while, yes. I mean, in the early days, we used to have a roster. I mean, no one was paid. We had absolutely no money for the first 6 months.
As well as this work, setting up and volunteering with Elsie, the first women's refuge in Sydney, your career as an author and as a journalist was really taking off. You had big success with your first book, Damned Whores and God's Police, which reimagined the role of women in Australian history. But around this time, Anne, you got some bad news from home. What had happened?
During that first year in journalism, you know, we discovered that my youngest brother, Jamie, who was then age 15, had cancer. And this was the most shocking thing that you could have possibly imagined. I didn't know children could get cancer, and it's never. I mean, we know a lot more about cancer now. We had no idea that a kid could get cancer, let alone that he could die of it, and he did die 18 months later, just 17.
How did you and your family handle that loss?
Well, it I mean, the thing, it did bring us together in a very kind of, I guess it was a necessary way that, you know, my father was the one who rang me to tell me that Jamie had cancer. And my father, when I picked up the phone, you know, I could hear this sort of choking noise, and I thought, oh, there he is, drunk again. You know, I thought he was throwing up. And in fact, I think he was, but it wasn't because he was drunk. It was because he was just so upset. I think we set aside a lot of the resentment and the hatred, and we came together to be there for Jamie.
Do you think that for you, part of dealing with that was focusing on your professional ambitions? Did that renew your kind of engagement with the world that you'd entered through journalism and through writing?
No, not at all. Because, I mean, I was completely unmoored by it. You know, I really just didn't know what to do. And I was, I had a holiday. I went for it to the United States for a holiday. I went to New York, and I'd never been there before, and I was kind of interested to see whether it was somewhere I might be able to stay. It just seemed to me that I couldn't go back to the same life, and I couldn't go back to just being a journalist at the National Times after this terrible thing had happened. And I guess that's probably a very common reaction when somebody close to you dies, but this was the first time it had ever happened to me. And the fact that it had happened to, you know, my baby brother was just, you know, it was just something I couldn't really comprehend. But, I mean, in the end, I didn't stay in New York. I didn't see how I could survive there because I had no way of making any money. I didn't think I could get a proper job there. I didn't have anywhere to live. So I did go back to my job. And I guess when something like that happens, it does change you. But you then, I mean, what grief is all about is learning to keep on going and to live with with this terrible loss and this terrible sadness, but you can't not go back to the real world. It just takes some time, and eventually you have to do that.
You were appointed as Canberra political correspondent for the Australian Financial Review. How confident were you of being up to that role when you started?
I was very, very flattered because Max Walsh, who was the editor of the paper and a very, very preeminent journalist, and he had been very praiseworthy of a lot of the journalism that I'd done at the National Times. I'd done some fairly groundbreaking stuff and some stuff that I'd won a Walkley in my first year, for example. I'd done some stories, not always by myself, some of them were in fact group stories, where we'd written about issues like rape, issues that were never discussed in the newspapers back then except in the crime pages, you know, and we'd found ways to write about it. It was sort of the era of new journalism where the journalist could insert herself in the story, you could have opinions, you could talk about people's motivation. It wasn't just a straight who, what, where, when of normal journalism. So Max Walsh had been impressed by my journalism, and he said, he offered me the job of political correspondent in Canberra, and I thought, wow, I mean, I'd never been... First of all, I hadn't been in daily journalism. I'd never done political writing, and I'd never worked in Canberra. So three quite massive changes, and I was terrified.
Did you let the people you were working with see that?
I tried not to. I was confident in the sense that because he was confident in me, and he did me a huge favour. He wrote... his letter of appointment to me was very long, you know, it was 4 or 5 pages, and it was set out in quite some detail what he expected of me and how he thought I should do the job. And it turned out to be like an instruction manual for how to be a political correspondent in Canberra. It was just a brilliant letter, which I still have. And I have always been so grateful to him for giving me this opportunity because it enabled me to, or forced me to overcome my own fear and my own feeling of lacking of confidence and to do the job, and I ended up being able to do it quite well. And I stayed there for 5 years.
When you were working in that role in Canberra, you decided to buy a house. What happened when you went to the bank?
Well, you know, I was the political correspondent. I think I was actually the bureau chief by then. I was the bureau chief for the Australian Financial Review, the preeminent financial newspaper in the country, in fact, the only one. But I was on a high salary. It was $30,000, which in those days was a lot of money. I had no debts. I had no obligations. I had nothing. I had a company car, so they paid for that. I had a huge expense account, so I never had to pay for anything. So I went and applied for the loan for what was, in those days was the Bank of New South Wales, now Westpac. And they said, no, we don't lend money to women.
And what year was this, Anne?
It was 1979. So Max Walsh wrote them a letter, you know, the managing editor of the Financial Review wrote them a letter saying, attesting to my ability to pay and the fact that the Financial Review had a rather dim view of banks not lending money to people who had the ability to pay them, pay the loans back. They wouldn't do it. They would not give me the money. So in the end, I had to go to a friend whose father had some big job in the Commonwealth Bank, and they said they would lend it to me, but I'd need a male guarantor. And so my friend had to sign. So many stupid things like that. I mean, when we sort of look at how much has changed, you know, a lot has changed and things like that, and a lot hasn't changed, or if, you know, things have got worse in different ways. But there were a lot of just really stupid things. That was one. And the other one was the fact that women had to resign from their permanent jobs when they got married, you know, up until 1966. I mean, that didn't affect me because that was before my time, but it affected a very large number of women, and it had a catastrophic effect on the economy because it took all these qualified women out of jobs. It was just ridiculous.
You were then given the opportunity to get up close to political power in Canberra. What role were you offered?
One of the things that Labor had done and which helped them win was to appeal to the women's vote. And one of the promises they'd made was that they would revive what was known as the Office for Women, and which under Fraser had been parked in a very lowly area of the bureaucracy, that they would revive it, bring it into the Prime Minister's Department, rename it the Office of the Status of Women, upgrade it in terms of its bureaucratic status and clout, and you know, really give it some juice to do things. And so Senator Susan Ryan, who was the minister assisting the Prime Minister on women, rang me and suggested I apply for the job as head of the office. And I was very startled to get that call because I'd never considered doing something like going to the bureaucracy. But at the same time, having been in Canberra for 5 years, I knew only too well the extraordinary power that Prime Minister and Cabinet, or PM&C as it's known, had. And I thought, wow, I mean, the opportunity to take my feminist views into the bureaucracy, into a policy-making area with the kind of support of the Prime Minister, who was very strongly supporting these issues, and try and achieve some really big change. I mean, it was really was irresistible. So after a lot of agonising.
What acronym were you told was going to be used to refer to
On my
this
first
office?
Day, I was shown the org chart for the department, and every division had an acronym, and like Cabinet was CAB, and International was INT. And then they said to me, well, this is you, and it was SOW, Status of Women. I said, no way.
Was that a deliberate job?
Well, I think it was. I mean, I don't know for sure, but it certainly, it couldn't rest. It couldn't stand. You couldn't have the Office of Women having the name of a female pig. You couldn't have it.
So what did you change it to?
OSW. So I just went to the head of the department. I said, no, got to change.
What was Bob Hawke like to work with?
He was great. I mean, everybody used to say to me, well, you know, he's such a womanizer and he's not somebody who is renowned for his feminist views. But he was somebody who, he told me he'd read The Second Sex, Simone de Beauvoir, The Second Sex, so that was impressive. And he certainly understood, as somebody who'd come from the trade union movement, you know, about women's rights, particularly working women's rights. He understood about childcare. I mean, we did some massive childcare stuff under the Hawke government. We set in train the kind of approach to childcare that, you know, despite many, many turns and twists of the childcare's policy in this country, we now accept that the government should provide funding for childcare to be there. And the arguments always are about, well, how much subsidy should there be and how much private sector should be involved and all that. But the basic proposition that the federal government should fund it was established in those days and has continued. So he was very, very good on stuff like that.
And what was the Prime Minister wearing 1 January when you went to visit Hazel Hawke at Kirribilli?
Oh, dear. I was asked to help Hazel Hawke prepare a speech that she was going to be giving to the National Press Club later in January. So I went up to Sydney and went around to Kirribilli House where they were in my bureaucrats, you know, my femocrat, as we used to call ourselves. feminist bureaucrat. I was in the femocrat regalia of beige suit, you know, low-heeled shoes and carrying a briefcase. And I was directed to walk around to the front of Kirribilli House, which, you know, the lawns that run down to the harbour, and you know, the photos you saw recently of Prince Harry and Meghan, you know, standing in that very spot. So I was walking around there looking for Hazel, and I saw this person, and I didn't really recognise him. And the guy said, "G'day, Anne." And I looked, and there was this tiny little man, I mean, almost completely naked, except for this tiny little pair of red Speedos, and his whole body was sort of daubed in zinc cream and stuff. And it was the Prime Minister. So I felt distinctly overdressed, and I said, "Hello, Prime Minister. I'm here to see the missus." It
must have been such heady times, though, Anne, when you're describing those changes that were introduced, those policy changes, those really tangible things like childcare. And, you know, what was it like sitting around tables nutting this stuff out with Hawke, working out what you'd prioritise, how you'd make these changes?
Well, you didn't sit down with Hawke doing this. I mean, he's the one who will have the ultimate say, but you'd be working it out with other bureaucrats and, you know, maybe some of the political advisers. But in fact, it was armed combat. It was incredibly difficult because there was so much opposition. And I mean, I wasn't surprised that there was opposition from within the bureaucracy. Bureaucrats didn't want, you know, all this newfangled stuff and all this women's stuff. And, you know, they thought we were, you know, we were seen as missionaries, and, you know, we were interlopers coming in there trying to change all this wonderful system that they had. And they just wouldn't accept the fact that there might be a political mandate to do this stuff. So it really was hand-to-hand fighting. But what shocked me even more than that was the fact that there were a number of men people, in cabinet who had a similar view, and we faced tremendous opposition.
You celebrated your 40th birthday while you were in this role. We had a big party, and Bob and Hazel came to that, as well as your parents. Mm-hmm. Were your parents impressed by having the Prime Minister and his wife at your birthday party?
Yes, they were. So my father, you know, who was very very big on dressing well. You know, he's Sartorially quite splendid in many ways. He was very unimpressed by the fact that Bob Hawke was wearing skull sandals.
But hopefully more than the Speedos this time.
Yeah, no, I think he had long pants on. It was nighttime.
How was your dad at that party?
Oh, he was okay at the party, but he and my mother had driven over from Adelaide to be with me for the 40th birthday, and they, so we had the party, and it was quite a small party, but I think everybody in the place gave me a bottle of champagne as a present, so we had a lot of booze in the house afterwards. And my father's drinking had become very, very bad. I mean, he used to go through phases where he'd stop drinking and he'd go into rehab and he'd do all that stuff, but then he'd have a lapse, and he was having a very bad lapse at this time. And one morning, a few days after the party, my mother was sleeping in the spare bedroom. My father was downstairs in this little bedroom off the kitchen. And then that morning I, you know, came downstairs and this terrible, terrible scene where my father was covered in blood. The walls of his bedroom were covered in blood. I mean, it really looked like a murder scene. There's just blood everywhere, and he was in a shocking state. I mean, he was incoherent and he was clearly very, very drunk.
And had he cut himself, or where was the blood?
Well, I mean, we couldn't really figure it out. It turned out he must have cut himself. There was a lot more blood. It looked a lot worse than it was. You know, he wasn't injured badly. I mean, he must have been suffering a lot from the grog, but he wasn't in a life-threatening situation. But, I mean, it was just, my mother was just, you know, had enough of him. She didn't know what to do. I didn't know what to do. So I rang these really good friends of mine in Canberra, and they came over, and Gary O'Neill, he sort of packed up all the booze from the house and took it away. And Mez, his wife, a very good friend of mine, she said, okay, she got on the phone and started ringing places in Canberra to see if we could find somewhere that would take him. And no one would. And we didn't know what to do. So we went to Woden Valley Hospital, to the emergency room. We thought, you know, we could get some treatment there. And they wouldn't take him either. They said, no. So we just didn't know what to do, and we were like sitting there in this horrible, you know, waiting room on these plastic chairs. And Mez said to my father, she said, Austin, his name was Austin, she said, Austin, would you just come with me for a minute? I want to have a talk with you. And she took him off down the other end of the passageway or wherever we were, and they were there for a long time and had a big talk, and then they came back, and Mez said, well, I think we'll go home now. And so she drove us home, and she cleaned up the bedroom and got rid of all the blood, and he had a shower and he went to bed. And Mez went home, and my mother and I just sat around miserably. And the next morning, my father came and said to my mother, he apologised for what had happened, and he said, "I'll never drink again." And my mother was extremely sceptical because he'd said that many times, but this time he meant it, and he never drank again.
What did your friend say to him?
Well, I used to say to her for years after, I said, "What in the hell did you say to him? I mean, what could you do that years of AA, years of rehab, years of my mother being so miserable and nothing had worked, and you take him down the hall for half an hour and you've changed our lives?" I mean, she just had a heart-to-heart with him, and something about either what she said or the way she said it got through to him in a way that, like, I know when I gave up smoking, I know this is not comfortable, but when I gave up smoking, I was hypnotised. And I had tried to give up smoking a million times and couldn't do it. But I went and got hypnosis, and the guy just had one session with me for 1 hour and told me I was never going to smoke again, and I never did. So I don't think that Mez hypnotised him, but she was able to break through whatever his protective barriers were and just say, "Austin, this has got to stop. You know, you're destroying your family, you're destroying yourself, you're making everybody miserable, you've got to stop or you're going to lose everything." And it, I mean, he lived for another 5 or 6 years, and they were the happiest of my parents' life.
You're listening to Conversations with Sarah Konofsky on ABC Radio.
And you were describing how things kind of hit rock bottom with your dad, and then this marvellous, miraculous change almost happened. You had a phone call with your dad not long before he died. Mm. What did you say to one another?
It's probably still quite hard to talk about. I mean, after Jamie died, you know, we had this kind of truce, but we didn't really... I couldn't forgive him. I couldn't find it in myself to forgive him, and he... I think he got cancer. He got prostate cancer, and he started to fade. And he suddenly became, you know, this threatening figure from my past. Suddenly became this sort of frail, incapacitated old man, and it was really kind of sad to see it. And he kept saying, you know, that he'd been knackered. He'd had his testicles removed as treatment, the barbaric treatment back then for prostate cancer. So he felt he'd lost his manhood. He'd lost his health. He was incredibly depressed. I was living in New York, so I didn't see him that often, but I came back for my brother's wedding, and he was very, very unwell then. You could see he wasn't going to last much longer. He'd written me a letter because I'd just done this business deal in New York, and I was, I'd suddenly been transformed from this rebellious teenager who he hated because I wasn't the kind of daughter that he fantasized about. He wanted somebody, you know, glamorous, and he wanted somebody I wasn't. But then I suddenly became this business owner. I became quite glamorous because I was a magazine editor in New York, and that was the uniform. And he'd written me this letter just saying how proud he was of me that I'd done this deal. Just saying how he knew how hard it would be. He's a businessman himself. He said pleasing bankers is like walking through fire with kerosene boots on. And he said it's going to be very, very hard for you, but I hope you'll be okay. I hope you'll succeed. And I went to Adelaide for this wedding, and I saw him, and I didn't acknowledge the letter that he'd written because I still was angry with him. But I realised when I saw him that he wasn't going to live much longer, and I thought that I had to I had to do it, and I couldn't do it to his face. But I went back to Sydney on my way back to New York, and I rang him from a friend's place, and we had the conversation, and I said I forgave him, and he apologised. It's sort of incredible. All these years later, it's still very tough to talk about.
You wrote him a letter as well, explaining how you felt about him, and I think acknowledging your gratitude to him amidst all of that difficulty.
I wrote the letter as soon as I got back to New York, And I said to him, you know, I was listening to Kiri Takanawa as I was writing it and saying, you know, one of the things that I'd inherited from him was a love of opera. And I was just trying to sort of say all the things about him that I admired and that were good. And anyway, I sent it off and he died the day before it got there. But, no, I've talked about it before. I haven't cried before. I don't know why. But anyway, the letter arrived and my mother read it and she was very, very pleased to have it. And she sort of wrote all over it, you know, never to be destroyed. So after she died, many, many years later, I found it. I found the letter again in her things. So I have it.
The business deal that your dad was so proud about and was to do with the magazine Ms. in New York. You'd moved there to work with Fairfax and had got to know Sandra Yates, another Australian working with Fairfax. She had started up a teen magazine called Sassy, and she wanted you to help her get Fairfax to buy Ms. so that you could become its editor, which was a really big deal. Tell me about Ms. magazine.
Well, Ms. Magazine was started in 1972 by Gloria Steinem, you know, who's an iconic American feminist, and it was the idea of it was to be a kind of a commercial magazine based on feminist principles, and so it would be, you know, its subject matter, the things it would write about would be topics of interest to women, but not from the traditional women's magazine point of view. It would be pointing out all of the things that were wrong and the injustices, as well as celebrating women's successes and so on. It did very well for about 10 years, but then it started to founder. I think feminism changed and the magazine didn't change. It became very kind of predictable and not very interesting. But it was still very iconic, and I mean, you'll still find people who swear by the Ms. magazine during that era because it was the only thing around. But Sandra was convinced that she could bring her commercial skills to it, and I would reinvent it editorially, strongly feminist, but a more sort of journalistically interesting magazine, and one that would be provocative and, you know, would basically be a great magazine with great stories told from a feminist perspective. And we were convinced that we could do it. And they bought the magazine. I think they paid $14 million for it. And I think it was only, forget the timing now, but we know it was within 3 months anyway of our taking control of Ms. And I was working on the first issue. And the young Warwick Fairfax launched his takeover bid for the family company. And the whole place was put into absolute chaos. And he decided to sell all the overseas properties, including Ms. and Sassy. So, you know, we'd done all this work trying to convince Americans, Madison Avenue and, you know, the whole magazine business that Fairfax was this, you know, incredibly respectable and interesting and reliable Australian media company and they could trust us. And then suddenly it was all gone. Sandra then got on the phone and she negotiated a 5-week option to buy the magazine. And they agreed. They said, okay, if you can raise that money, you can have them. And so she said, okay, we need $20 million. And so it took a while.
You had 5 weeks or so to raise $20 million.
Five weeks, yes.
How did you do that?
Well, we hired a broker, a magazine broker, and she got us all sorts of meetings. And, I mean, what had happened is Sassy had been launched. Sassy was incredibly successful, and every media company in the world wanted to buy Sassy. Rupert Murdoch, New York Times, Condé Nast, Hearst, they all wanted to buy it. But none of them wanted Ms. Nobody wanted Ms. And so Sandra and I said, well, look, we always thought we were going to save Ms. We are going to save Ms. We are going to raise the money ourselves rather than just sell Sassy. And we could have sold Sassy for a lot of money and walked away and been rich. And why didn't we do that?
You must have asked yourself that sometimes. Wonder about these meetings with this, you know, you have the broker, but you're going in asking for so much money. You're two Australian women who haven't been long really in the city. What were you wearing to these events, San?
Well, again, Sandra, who was, you know, sort of the brains behind this, said, you know, doctor, people don't lend money to people who look like they need it, so we've got to go and get ourselves some outfits. So we both went off you know, I went to and got a personal shopper, and I got this fantastic suit, you know, this red power suit, Anne Klein suit, shoulder pads. And
how big were those shoulder pads?
Very big. And it was a fantastic suit, and she went and got herself a Valentino suit. So she said to us, well, either we're going to raise this money or we'll be the best dressed bag ladies in New York. And we did it. I mean, we can't believe we did it.
So you took it over, you managed to raise the money to buy Ms. and Sassy, yes. And you were editor-in-chief of Ms.
Yes.
What happened?
We formed a company called Matilda Publications, and Matilda became the new publisher of Ms. and Sassy, taking over from Fairfax. And that was on the 1st of July 1988. And 6 weeks later, I went down to the Democratic Party convention in Atlanta and swanned around enjoying my new status as the person everybody wanted to meet, because I ran Ms. Magazine and did what Gloria Steinem had never done. I raised the money to...
Did people look askance at you as an Australian, or was...
Some people did. Yeah, but there was a hell of a lot of goodwill towards me, and a lot of curiosity to see what I'd do, and people were really interested to see whether or not we could make a go of it.
So lots of party invitations.
Absolute A-list. Every night I could have gone to 10 things. It was just incredible. But 6 weeks later, I mean, I was at the convention. I got back to the hotel. This is, no mobile phones in those days. I got back to the hotel. There's a message from Sandra, call me no matter how late. And I called her, and I think it was 1 o'clock in the morning, and she said, the bad news is that our top six advertisers have just cancelled. That's a $25 million in revenue that we've just lost today. And that was the beginning of the end. And what had happened is that a group of women in the Midwest who called themselves Women Aglow, one of them had got a copy of Sassy, had come in, or it wasn't even the magazine, it was a direct mail offer for Sassy, and she had seen it and thought it was disgusting, because I think it said something about, helping girls to make sure the girls don't get pregnant, avoiding teenage pregnancy, which was a bit of a mission of Sassy's, because at that time, America had the highest teenage pregnancy rate in the world. And they were outraged by this, and so they wrote us a letter of complaint.
So they were evangelical mothers, Women Aglow.
Yeah, they were religious. Women Aglow with the love of Jesus or something. And they wrote us a letter, which we just didn't take seriously. I don't even know if we answered it, but anyway, we certainly didn't take it seriously. And so they were so annoyed, they went to Jerry Falwell, and he certainly took it seriously.
Who was Jerry Falwell?
Well, he ran an organisation called the Moral Majority, which was very, very big in the 80s. And they also went to a couple of other right-wing religious groups. And these groups said, yep, okay, we'll help you. And so they organised this massive letter-writing campaign to us. And then, we started getting hundreds and hundreds of letters every day, and we certainly took that seriously. But we still didn't think that it would destroy us, because, the magazine was so successful. I mean, the advertising was pouring in. We had $25 million worth of bookings, and that was a lot of money. It was more than we'd raised. It was a lot of money. And the sales were going, the subscriptions were going through the roof, and girls loved it. It was just, we couldn't see what could go wrong. Then they said they were so emboldened by having run this letter-writing campaign, they decided to go after the advertisers. So Jerry Falwell et al. Organised form letters for these people to send to the presidents of our six major advertisers. So it was Revlon, it was Tambrands, Mac Tampax, it was Just Jeans, Reebok, the whole lot of major, major American companies. And most of the companies didn't get more than 100 letters, but that was enough for them to say, okay, this magazine is too dicey for us, and they withdrew their advertising. And, we battled on for I think another 9 months, and it was the worst time of my life, trying to finance it again, trying to raise more money. Sandra left the company at the bank's insistence. They kept me on, which was a very mixed blessing. I had to try and make sure that they didn't do anything else to upset advertisers, so we could try and bring them back in. Eventually, all our options ran out, and we had to sell.
There were some highlights in this very, very rough year or so of yours, though. Who did you meet late one night in the photocopy room at his?
Yes, I guess my life changed. That was the only good thing that happened that year, and this was 1989, was I met Chip Rowley, who was actually on the staff of Ms. Magazine.
How many fellas were working at Ms. Magazine?
There are a few. Well, we had two magazines. We had Ms. and Sassy, and we had we had 75 people on our staff. I mean, it was majority women, but there were a few men. And Chip is a very interesting and unusual man, and he was certainly, he's raised by a feminist. He's got very strong feminist views. And we're still together 29 years later.
Must have been an incredibly high-stress environment to start a relationship, thinking about what you were dealing with emotionally, professionally.
It was, I don't know how he put up with me. I really don't. I was so stressed. I've never been as stressed in my life. I'm not really cut out for that sort of life, I decided. So I'd go home at night and I'd, you know, once I got inside my apartment, I'd pour a glass of scotch and burst into tears. I think I did that every night for about a month. And so Chip must have thought he was had hooked up with a mad woman. But he was incredibly supportive. I don't know how I would have got through it if I'd been by myself. It was having somebody there. So, I mean, it was also very stressful for him because he didn't know if he was going to lose his job. But he's a very, very kind of wise and empathetic person.
Wise beyond his years, perhaps, because yes. He's quite a bit younger than you.
He's 19 years younger than I am, yes, yes. Which, I mean, seemed like a big deal at the beginning, but not something we even notice anymore.
Eventually, Anne, you returned to Canberra to take up a job in politics again, this time as a political advisor to Paul Keating. What opinion did you have of Keating before you started working with him?
Oh, well, I've known Keating for many, many years. I knew him from the press gallery when I worked in, because you know, he was the shadow minister for minerals and energy, and the Financial Review was the only paper that covered resource policy, so he used to be in our office all the time. No, I knew him and I liked him, but you know, I knew what a very tough operator he was. But I didn't think he would want me to work for him because I'd worked for Bob Hawke. And when they'd had their leadership moustache, I had taken Hawke's side. Not that I had a vote or anything, but when asked about it, I would say that I thought Hawke should stay in the job. But anyway, so I didn't think that Keating would really want me in his office, but he did. He decided he'd try it out.
What in particular did he want you there for?
Oh, well, he had a problem with the women's vote.
What didn't women like about him?
Well, they didn't know. They just knew there was a problem and they didn't know how to fix it. So they said, well, let's get Summers in. So I came, you know, supposedly for 3 months. I ended up staying for 11 months. But, you know, when I got there, I said to them, well, why don't women like him? And they said, oh, because he's, you know, so aggressive in question time. I said, well, I know lots of women who think that's great. They didn't really know, and I said, well, we have to find out. You know, you can't just go blind. You can't just sort of, if you don't know why people don't like him, you can't change things. So I was able to get them to agree to commission some very extensive research. We used a woman called Barbara Riley Smith, brilliant researcher when it comes to doing focus groups and not only hearing what's said, but hearing what's not being said. And she did focus groups all around the country, in every capital city and several regional areas, asking women. And the women who were chosen were all women who were receiving some kind of Commonwealth benefit. So they weren't really rich people and they weren't really poor people. But they were mostly working, but they were kind of middle-income people but who had some in receipt of some government payments. And we wanted to know what they thought about their lives as women. And we didn't ask them what they thought of Keating. I mean, sometimes they volunteered it, but they weren't asked that. They were asked about what was wrong with their lives, what would make it better. And what would make Australia better and what would make Australian women's lives better? And the answer to the second question about what women wanted was remarkably uniform across the country. And the three things that the women said they wanted were childcare, something on women's health, and something done about violence against women. And I was really staggered by this. I mean, absolutely staggered, because even though I'd been involved in starting ELSI and clearly I knew about domestic violence and knew it was a problem, I didn't have any idea of how extensive a problem it was, so much so that in some of the groups, every woman mentioned it. And clearly there were a lot of women in those groups who were experiencing forms of violence. So I realised that we had to do something about it, and I didn't know what to do because, well, first of all, it wasn't really within the purview of the federal government back then. So what could we do? Childcare, you know what to do. You just have to persuade the bastards to give you the money. And as I'd already found out previously when I worked at OSW, that was not easy. Women's health was also not so difficult. I mean, there were lots of things we could and did do. One of the things that women wanted saved, of course, was Medicare, which was under attack then. They wanted Medicare saved for their families. But they also wanted Barbara, in this sort of listening to what women were saying underneath what they were saying, you know, what they were really saying, she thought that when they talked about women's health, they were talking about their own kind of personal integrity, their desire to have some me time, their desire to have to be something other than the full-time wife, mother. They wanted to sort of reclaim the girl they used to be. They wanted to be appreciated. And so he sort of put into all of Keating's speeches from then on, thanking women and just trying to make lines that were natural, that weren't too forced or contrived, but just trying to get across the view that women's contribution to the country was appreciated. And, of course, on election night when he won, he thanked the women of Australia, and that was really a really great thing to do.
Tell me about the first time you flew on the VIP aircraft with Paul Keating. What was that experience like?
It was fantastic. I mean, I was thrilled to fly because I was just a blow-in. I wasn't expected to travel, didn't travel with him much or anything. So when I got a chance to go on this trip to Perth, I was very excited. And he invited me to sit next to him on the plane. When he was carrying this very battered old briefcase. I mean, it was honestly, it must have been about 60 years old. It was so battered. And he sits down and he opens the briefcase and he pulls out a whole bunch of CDs and he gives them to the steward we're on the VIP, and and the stewards, of course, knew, they'd obviously done it before. So the minute we were up in the air, the music came sort of blaring through the cabin. I think it was Mahler. I can't remember, but it probably was Mahler. And then he was fumbling around in this bag and he got out a book. And it was a blue cloth covered book. And it was basically a guide to the architecture of Georgian Sydney. So it was every Georgian house in Sydney. And it was, and he is an expert in Georgian architecture. I mean, really a renowned expert. And so he was just sort of taking me through this book and showing me which houses still existed. And most of them, of course, don't, sadly. And it was just a really, a side of Keating that I hadn't really seen. I mean, I had seen it in part. I mean, I remember this. A time I ran into him just down near the lake outside the High Court, back when I'd been in the press gallery. The High Court had been opened, so it must have been 1980, I think, had been opened the night before by the Queen. And I'd said to him, oh, this building, what a shocking waste of money that is. And he just said to me, you can never spend too much money on a public building. And I was taken aback by that. I mean, I was completely unused to that kind of a view. Everybody else, the Canberra journalists and most of the politicians, were very cynical people. And he said, no, you can never invest too much in the public. And he said, and he turned around, he pointed up the hill. He said, that building up there, and they'd just started building the new Parliament House, the one that's now Parliament House. And he said, that building is going to do so much for Australian crafts, because the stonemasons and the carpenters and, the people who weave the wool and who make the furniture, all those people will not only get work, but they will create wonderful Australian products. And I just thought, wow, no one's ever spoken to me like that before. And that just really, again, opened my eyes to a new thought about the utility of spending money on the public, but also another side of Keating.
Keating, of course, after that success that you witnessed, was then defeated in 1996 by John Howard. Then we had Kevin Rudd, then Julia Gillard, then Rudd, and then, of course, it all gets too confusing for any of us to keep up with. Was Australia ready for a female Prime Minister when Julia Gillard came along?
Well, I mean, this is such an interesting question because we thought so. I mean, when she got the job, there was palpable joy across the land. The way in which the newspapers celebrated, those incredible photographs of Quentin Bryce, the first female Governor-General, swearing in, Australia's first female Prime Minister. These beautiful photographs were everywhere. And everybody was so happy because people really liked Julia. She was really, really popular when she was a Deputy Prime Minister. And so I think we were kind of unprepared for what happened. And I still don't really know exactly how it happened, but I became aware after about a year or so that things were very awry and that people were talking about her in a way that was, that politics is a very rough business and people are very brutal, but there was just a kind of a language being used about her and a tone and a tenor to the criticisms of her that seemed to be more to do with her sex than to do with her competence. She wasn't being criticised for being a bad policymaker. She'd been criticised because she was a woman. And I then decided that I would sort of start keeping a bit of an eye on this because, as part of my general interest, politics, women, all that stuff. And I became really quite shocked to see just how extensive and how vitriolic it was. And I discovered that there was this, disgusting cartoonist called Larry Pickering who was doing these cartoons of her naked carrying a dildo, and that they were all really vile cartoons. And he would send that one of these every day to every member of parliament. And no one ever said a word about it. You know, no journalist got onto it. No one reported it. And when I discovered this, I was just sort of staggered that the press gallery had really, you know, dropped the ball on a really new form of political attack, and one that was being directed against a woman. And so we had to sort of ask ourselves, well, why is it that we can't deal with having a woman lead us? We don't mind having a woman as our deputy prime minister. We love it. But we can't deal with the woman in charge. And the fact that she was, so I often sort of thought to myself, well, you know, if Quentin Bryce had been the prime minister, would it have been different? I mean, Quentin Bryce has 5 children, dressed differently, married, Christian. Would Australia have reacted to her differently? And I think that's unanswerable. We don't know whether it's the fact that she's a woman or whether the fact that she was single and an atheist and living in sin and had red hair and, you know, all the other things that were said about her. Her jackets, you know, according to Jermaine Greer. We don't really know, and we've got to, I hope, get another one as soon as possible to start getting used to it and to start learning to cope with the fact that, I mean, New Zealand's had 3 women prime ministers, and they can deal with it, and we've got to learn how to deal with it.
And you're in your 8th decade now.
Yes.
Is ageing like you were told it would be when you were growing up?
No, not at all, because, I mean, it's different because, I mean, first of all, you keep working. I'm keeping on working. I don't have a job as such, but I've never worked harder in my life. And I think one of the things I think about myself, and I don't mean just me, but my generation of women, is that we had to kind of learn by doing it how to be a woman, because the definition of woman that we were given when we were young in the 50s. Didn't work for us, didn't suit us. It was passé already by then. But we knew that was wrong, but we didn't know what the new life should be. And so we've had to kind of make it up as we go along. And it's been a really interesting process. But, I mean, it's still an exciting journey, I think, an exciting adventure, figuring out how far we can push this thing that we call life.
I'm very excited to hear you pushing it and learn a bit about this extraordinary life that you're still very much in the midst of living. And thank you so much for being my guest on Conversations.
Oh, it's been great. Thank you, Sarah.
This is Conversations with Sarah Konoski on ABC Radio.
Anne Summers, and Anne's most recent book, the memoir, is called Unfettered and Alive. I'm Sarah Konoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Konoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.